We're going to call the State Government Finance Committee meeting to order. Members, in your packet, you have the minutes for April 5th, 2016. And Representative Anderson, you want to move the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
He was not present at the last meeting. He's excused. So he can't.
Okay. We can amend it to. Oh, yeah, you're right. Oh, I apologize. I didn't even look at that.
Madam Chair.
So, Representative Nelson, will you move the minutes then for me?
I'll move the minutes for the last meeting.
All right, thank you. So, Representative Nelson moves the minutes for April 5th, 2016. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, the minutes are adopted. Folks, we're going to start off with House File 3211, Representative Joe Hoppe's bill. I'm going to move the bill for Representative Hoppe, and if you just want to give us a brief explanation of what your bill does.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is House File 3211. It is a bill that both of these states' racetracks support, and I have here two gentlemen from the Racing Commission that can explain it in more detail.
Great. Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, Tom DePasquale, Executive Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission, and this is Joe Sturdo, Deputy Director of the Racing Commission. Madam Chair and members, thank you for having us today on 3211. This bill has been through three other committees in the House and Senate and has enjoyed unanimous support from all members of the legislature. We're here in part at your request. You may recall last year we came to your committee and you were instrumental in securing an appropriation for the commission, and we thank you for that. It was an appropriation of $341,000 to bridge us through this biennium and get us to the next and make up for a shortfall in our operating budget. Again, our operating budget comes from license fees, which are imposed on the racetracks by statute, and they pay the lion's share of our operating costs, and then we also license over 5,000 individuals and vendors, and they make up the rest of our operating budget. That revenue stream for the commission has been relatively flat over the years, over many years, and our costs have increased. And that's the basic cause of our deficit. So you asked us to report back after working in consultation with the racing industry on how we might secure a dedicated funding stream for the commission going forward without having to rely on general appropriations. We did that. We held a number of stakeholder meetings with the tracks and the horsepersons groups and other representatives from Minnesota's racing industry. And we reported in a very handsome report dated November 2015 on a range of options that were considered by the commission for future funding. One of the things we did not want to do is impose greater burdens on our own racetracks. Today, the racetracks pay 88% of our funding. They not only pay statutory license fees, but they also pay reimbursement to the commission for the costs of veterinary services, medication testing, and oversight of their card rooms. So taken together, they pay a disproportionate share of our budget. So what we wanted to do was to try to make our funding more equitable, and identify opportunities that would not only secure funding for the commission, but help grow the racing industry in Minnesota, in particular, help the racetracks, help our breeders and owners. So what we identified is advanced deposit wagering as a ripe opportunity for regulation and licensing. So let me explain a 10,000-foot overview of what the bill does, and then if you want to drill down into the budget details, Mr. Sturdo would be happy to do that, but don't feel obligated to do so. Advanced deposit wagering is basically electronic wagering system whereby paramutual wagering, whereby people place funds on deposit with advanced deposit wagering providers, or ADWs as they're known in the industry. And those providers accept bets from persons who are registered with them, who sign up with them. And the wagers are debited to their account and winnings are credited to their account. You cannot bet on credit. Of course, you have to be over 18 years old to do that. Advanced deposit wagering is the major growth opportunity. It is the only source of growth in the racing industry today. California, just by way of example, 28% of all wagers on California races are placed through advanced deposit wagers. Other states, it also is a growth for wagering, and the reason for that is because of its convenience. Many of these companies offer rebates to customers, which makes their cost of wagering less than the people at the track. So in Minnesota, this has been an avenue of wagering for really the last 10 years or so. But it hasn't been licensed, it hasn't been expressly authorized in the state, and it in no way has contributed to our own racing industry. So the irony here is that Minnesota residents who are wagering on races out of state, we're not wagering on races at Canterbury or Running Aces, we're wagering on other states' races, and the financial benefit of those wagers is going to other states' racing industries. And it is of no benefit to the state of Minnesota, other than, to a certain extent, it's cannibalizing wagers that would otherwise take place at our state's racetracks. So what does the bill propose to do? The bill does what bills and or statutes in roughly 34 other parimutuel states do, and that is it establishes licensing criteria and regulatory oversight of these dozen or so companies by the Racing Commission. It allows us to recapture the outflow of these parimutuel revenues from other states and help put them to work in Minnesota for the benefit of our own industry. It also establishes consumer protections for Minnesota residents that they otherwise would not enjoy today. The funding will be used for regulatory oversight in the sense that we would get 1.25% of all amounts wagered, which would make up the difference between our licensing fees and our operating budget. It would also defray the costs of our administering the Breeders' Fund by about $50,000 a year, so there's an incremental benefit to our breeders in that sense, because today we charge back the costs of our administering the Breeders' Fund. And through the avenue of source market fees, monies would go to our racetracks, our breeders, and owners. The way that works in our bill is we've decided to leave that to the parties to negotiate. Many states set source market fees in statute or by rule. What this bill would do is allow Canterbury and Running Aces to negotiate with advanced deposit wagering companies and set a source market fee, which would be a fee on all wagers derived from Minnesota residents. Typically, that fee is 3 to 5%. And then that fee would be divided per the statute as between Running Aces and Canterbury, and then filter down, at least half of that would filter down to benefit purses and the breeding industry in Minnesota. So the statute leaves it to the parties to negotiate. They would bring that agreement to the commission. We would review it. We would make sure the ADWs have certain protections and plans of operation in place. They would have annual renewals. And that's how the system would work in Minnesota. Briefly, there's two other things the bill does. With respect to licensing, applicants who have been convicted or pled guilty to animal cruelty would no longer be suitable for licensing in the state of Minnesota. It also would allow for fines, which we collect in the amount of $25,000 to $30,000 a year, rather than putting those fines into the general revenue fund. They would be given to a special revenue fund and used for racehorse retirement and rehoming of Minnesota thoroughbreds and racehorses that come off the track. So that's the 10,000-foot overview of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. DePasquale. I do see that we have an amendment. Chair Hoppe, I'll move the A16-1024 amendment. Do you want to just briefly describe these technical corrections? Or?
Madam Chair and members, this amendment actually was suggested by Senate counsel prior to the bill going before the Senate State and Local Government Committee. And what it does is, in the bill, we've asked for exempt rulemaking authority, which is to say that we could get expedited rules in place to govern advanced deposit wagering in Minnesota. Under the exempt rulemaking statute in Minnesota, those rules sunset after 2 years. And Senate counsel suggested that once the rules are in place, there's really no reason for them to sunset. We're not going to redo them. So she suggested that we exempt ourselves from the paragraph that sunsets those rules after 2 years. They still go through a notice and comment process. They still are reviewed by the Office of Administrative Hearings. But we may find that there's a need to add to the statute's regulation of ADW with additional rules that we would promulgate ourselves, and that's the purpose of that. The other change is really just a language change to clarify when payments are to be made.
Okay. Members, do you understand the amendment? I think we'll just attach it to the bill, and then we can talk to the bill itself as to get it in the order that the author wishes.
We'll just question about that.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm asking this question because I don't want the bill to die, but has this bill gone to government operations? I don't remember seeing it there. And our house rules state that anything that exempts rules, requires rules, has to go to government operations. It's a mandatory referral. And so, and seeing as how this is deadline week, I don't want the bill to be killed by sending it someplace other than GovOps so that it can't, so that it dies because we haven't gone to GovOps.
You're very astute, Representative Nelson. We will be sending it to GovOps, so appreciate that comment. To get the bill in the order that the author wishes, I'm going to move the A-16-1024 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, the A-16-1024 amendment is adopted. Now, the bill as amended, we do have a fiscal note, members, in your packet. Ms. Roberts, would you be willing to walk us through the fiscal note?
Madam Chair and members, I'll do the best I can. I might need some assist on this. You can see on the first page of the fiscal note that the overall impact or net impact is showing a cost to the general fund of $27,000 beginning in fiscal year 2017, and that is a result of Section 16 of the bill that changes the deposit of fines from the general fund to the special revenue account. So that is a cost that will have to be tracked with this bill. The remaining and most of the impact of this bill is within the special revenue funds and the breeders fund, and as a result of the new license fee, and then primarily from the 1.25% regulatory fee, and that is discussed beginning on page 4 of the fiscal note. There's some discussion about how the regulatory fee is divided between the special revenue fund and the breeders fund in section 12. That's from section 12 of the bill. And then on page 5, there's additional detail on how the estimates were derived using a projection of $20 million per year wagered annually via the ADW providers. And then you can see the expenditure formulas. I don't know if you need to be walked through those, or I probably wouldn't turn to the agency.
I think we're sufficient on that. Mr. Skirto, is there anything else you wish to add?
Madam Chair, no, not at this time. That was well done, actually. There's a lot of formulas and numbers in there.
Members, any questions on the fiscal note or the bill itself? Representative Rundeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just noting that it says that there will be, under assumptions, there will be two ADW providers. I'm just wondering how that number's arrived at. I mean, is that sort of close off to competition, or is that all there are?
Mr. DePasquale.
Madam Chair, Representative, we decided not to limit the number of ADWs that could be licensed. There are three major ADWs in the country, and then smaller companies. Many of them do business in all jurisdictions. But because the tracks are going to be negotiating with ADW providers, we're just going to leave it to them as to how many they want to do business with.
Representative,
Madam Chair, so this two is something we should disregard. There may be more as the negotiations, or this is just for the basis of, for the fiscal note, it's kind of hypothetical, is that what we're saying?
Madam Chair, Representative, it is hypothetical. It's for the purposes of the note.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay.
I might add that
Mr. DePasquale.
Madam Chair, Representative, assumedly that's going to capture, if we get the three major ADWs, that's going to capture 80 or 90% of the ADW market as it exists today.
Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak to this bill? Members, any questions? Not, I'm going to renew my motion. Representative Detmer.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the Director, you mentioned the ADW fees are going to be
dispersed to the two racetracks. What percentage goes to one racetrack and the other racetrack, or are they treated the same?
Mr. DePasquale.
Madam Chair, Representative, the parties over the course of the last year negotiated amongst themselves as to how those source market fees would be distributed. Canterbury would receive 72% of all source market fees, irrespective of the breed on which the wager is made. Running Aces would receive 28% of those source market fees. And then the horse persons of the breeds that race at those tracks would receive 50% of the amounts that the track receives.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Detmer.
So that's done within house, negotiating. Those negotiations are done within house.
Mr. DePasquale.
Madam Chair, Representative, the negotiations for the distribution of the 50% that goes to the horse persons is a subject of negotiation between the horse people and the tracks.
Madam Chair, one last I guess the whole purpose of this legislation is to eventually get the industry to be self-supporting. Am I correct?
Mr. DePasquale.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes it is. We were looking for funding mechanisms from within the industry itself, and we were looking for funding mechanisms that would help support Minnesota's racing industry with the ultimate goal of increasing the number of Minnesota-bred horses and thereby helping the industry thrive in the long term in Minnesota.
Thank you.
I'm going to renew my motion that House File 3211, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the bill moves forward. Thank you, Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Albright, I understand you're going to be presenting House File 2789.
Me too.
Members, we're not going to be voting on this. This is just an informational hearing on this issue. Representative Albright, if you can briefly describe the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, the purpose of House File 2789 is specifically to discuss the velodrome that's up at the Blaine Sports Center. I have a couple of testifiers on behalf of the velodrome, but I'll give you a brief synopsis of the purpose of the bill, and then I will turn it over to my testifiers. Now, the velodrome was built in 1991 and originally was planned for a 20-year tenure, but candidly it's lived well beyond its original plan. And the location, as it's intended going forward, is actually repurposed for a charter school after the 2019 racing season. Even with only being able to train during the summer months from about April or May through October, the track has already created multiple world champions, as well as a number of Olympians, and I might add that it has spawned or generated 50 high school racing teams, and I might also add that Fire Lake participates in that sport as well, so I have a vested interest in seeing some of this progress made. The bill provides planning money to identify a new location and to begin planning for an indoor facility that will support this growing competitive sport in Minnesota, which, as I've stated, is being embraced very rapidly across the number of state high schools. The support for this bill will help both the process for a new home be found for the velodrome, as well as assist in the transition for the charter school, which is intended to occupy the space currently underneath the velodrome after the 2019 racing season. With that, I have two testifiers with me that can speak much more capably to this subject, and I will turn it over to them at this time. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Jason Lardy. I'm the president of the Minnesota Cycling Center. We are the organization that is working to build the next phase of track cycling here in Minnesota. The bill, House File 2789, is a modest investment to continue an existing state investment in youth cycling and adult cycling here in Minnesota. As Representative Albright pointed out, the National Sports Center Velodrome, our current home, has been 7 years past its shelf life. It has been maintained through state investment and volunteer donations and effort. In fact, this weekend we replaced 35 of the 4,200 boards in the track in 40-degree weather in the 50-mile-an-hour winds. So there's a lot of effort that's going on to maintain track cycling here in Minnesota. As Representative Albright pointed out, the track will be removed at the end of the 2019 racing season. In fact, at the end of the 2014 season, the track was closed by the National Sports Center because we had some concerns about the viability of the structure. We raised $150,000 to repair the structure and worked very hard as volunteers to repair the facility last spring, and we were able to successfully conduct an entire racing season last year as a result. Part of that contribution, that donation that we all made as volunteers, included a negotiation with the National Sports Center to allow us to race through the 2019 racing season, at which point they will close the facility and a Spring Lake Park School District sports-oriented charter school will be built on that site. So we are hoping to build a new phase in track cycling here in Minnesota with the opportunity to increase Minnesota's prominence in the national and international scene, as well as give youth more exciting and expanded opportunities to train and race so that they can continue their career and become active cyclists throughout their lives. The facility is going to host, or currently hosts, weekly racing series and championship level events that bring thousands of youth and adult riders from Minnesota and throughout the world. Each summer we hold a fellow kids youth camps. We also have activities for the Minnesota High School Cycling League during the summer. Youth cycling, as Gary Schoquist will later spend some time on, is growing rapidly in Minnesota. We have more than 50 teams in the Minnesota High School Cycling League, including teams from St. Cloud High School, St. Croix Valley Composite Team in Marine on St. Croix, Minnesota or Minnetonka Area High School, Waconia, Edina, Bloomington, Shakopee, the Twin Cities Academy here in St. Paul, and Prior Lake, which is one of the founding members of the league. We also have the largest field of women amateur racers in the United States here at the National Sports Center Velodrome. We've worked very hard to attract women racers, and they have become a very successful part of what we do. In fact, a newly minted world champion and just named Olympian for the United States, Kelly Catlin from Roseville, learned to race on the track in Blaine. So she is going to be representing the United States in Rio this summer in the track cycling discipline. If you've never seen a velodrome, it's an Olympic-style racetrack for bicycles, and it awards more medals in any discipline of cycling than road, mountain bike, and BMX combined. So it's very prominent on the international scene, and we're very proud to have developed so many different racers. We've had riders who are world champions built here. We've also had riders who have won stages of the Tour de France compete at our facility, as well as U.S. Olympians have all raced here in Minnesota. We draw thousands of fans and millions of media impressions annually to the Minnesota scene. The New York Times and Sports Illustrated are just a few of the publications that have featured Minnesota track cycling in their media coverage, including Kelly Catlin and her recent world championship victory. The bill, House File 2789, asks for an investment that would be given toward the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission as the fiscal agent for the property. So we are asking for a continuation of that investment through the Amateur Sports Commission, which operates the National Sports Center Velodrome today. The Minnesota Cycling Center will be different from the National Sports Center in that it will be a year-round indoor facility. The National Sports Center Velodrome is outdoors, and it's made out of wood, which limits its lifespan and puts us in the situation that we are in today. Not only will it allow us to have a much more viable long-term home for track cycling, it will also allow us to have Minnesota racers training year-round. So while the Minnesota High School Cycling League acts in the mountain bike season during the fall, they have no opportunities really to train during the winter, and so this facility would give them an opportunity to do that. Our vision for the facility is to be self-sustaining. Not only will it be self-sustaining through business, local business partnerships and a variety of events and daily activities, we have had two feasibility studies, one done by the National Sports Center and one done by Maxfield Research, that validate the assumptions of our business model and the fact that we can be self-sustaining by offering a multi-use facility. This is a very common methodology that's used by velodromes around the world, and we spent a great deal of time working with facilities in Europe and other places that operate multi-use velodrome facilities, and the mixed-use model is very important to the viability, and they believe that our facility will function successfully in that regard. We also intend to offer STEM-related curriculum in after-school programs based around the science of bicycles. We've partnered with Minneapolis Public Schools to develop a bike curriculum that emphasizes STEM, makes science more fun, practical, and approachable for students. And that's very important because studies have shown that the informal STEM programs that kids have access to are some of the main contributors to success in the classroom. So by offering kids those types of informal learning opportunities, we're giving the kids the opportunity to close the achievement gap that exists for so many kids in Minnesota schools today. So we're seeking, in addition to a new location that will be indoors and year-round, we're seeking a location that will be closer to more schools. Today, Blaine is a challenging location for many students. We do have racers who come from as far away as St. Cloud and Faribault to race on a regular basis, but that makes transportation very challenging for some of these kids, especially during the school day. So having a facility that's closer to more schools, easier to transport the kids to, and in fact might offer them a way to ride their bikes safely to the facility, is going to be a tremendous boost to both the student athletes who participate in racing programs and to the students who participate in our STEM curriculum as well. As we imagine the cycling center, we'll welcome 287,000 or more visitors annually. 150,000 people will be there for events. 4,000 plus student learners will come to our academic programming, and we'll have more than 400 student athletes competing in events throughout the year. It'll also create more than $8 million in economic impact based on our mixed-use business model. We'll create 100 or more construction jobs, 50 or more ongoing jobs through our business partners and our operations, and it will be a daily destination for guests from around its neighborhood and throughout Minnesota. Our modest investment will allow us to begin conversations with cities and stakeholders to identify an appropriate location. It will also identify challenges and opportunities that are faced by the sites that we've been evaluating. It allows us to make sure that we understand the potential construction challenges and the opportunities within those particular locations. And it gives us the opportunity to potentially accelerate the construction process for the new charter school that the Spring Lake Park School District would like to purchase, to build in Blaine. I'd like to introduce Gary Schoquist. Gary Schoquist is the Advocacy Director for Quality Bicycle Products. He's also a member of the International Mountain Bike Hall of Fame, and he is the founding chair of the Minnesota High School Cycling League. And he'll talk a little bit about youth cycling
here. Well, Mr. Lardy, I think that you've been very thorough. You guys have done an excellent job of the presentation. The materials have been very helpful. Mr. Schoquist, do you have anything new to add?
I just want to make a quick point, Madam Chair and committee members. What we've learned with Minnesota High School Cycling League is there are a tremendous amount of junior high and senior high students who are not ball and stick sport kind of kids. If they've had any kind of team experience, generally it's not been very good. What this cycling does is it appeals to everybody, 6th grade through 12th grade, boys and girls, people who just want to learn a lifetime activity and have the option to compete if they want. Our league is growing very quickly. We're approaching 1,000 high school racers this fall. So this facility really is important in terms of development. It'll be a hub for literally thousands of students who can ride their bicycles and get dropped off here to learn a new lifelong skill and compete if they want. In closing, I was at this committee in 2009 requesting funding for Cuyuna, a 25-mile mountain bike destination up by Crosby that has become a national destination and a huge economic driver. Please continue the investment in cycling by the state by supporting this. We're talking about five times as many annual users. So it's a very, very good thing for Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just a question, I guess, of either of you, but maybe Mr. Lardy, being that you provided most of the testimony. The request is for $250,000, and that includes the purchase of land. And as we all know, land can be pretty expensive in the metropolitan area, and you said you were evaluating various sites. Are some of those sites you're evaluating land that's already in the public domain? I'm just looking at the amount that you're talking about, $250,000 for a year-round facility, and we all know, like I said earlier, land can be expensive.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Lardy?
Madam Chair, Representative, we believe that this funding will help us begin the process of land acquisition. We recognize that there will not be a complete acquisition possible with this investment. Our intention is to have multiple funding sources, including private investment, and we will be asking for a larger contribution at some point, probably in the 2018 session. So this money is really going toward pre-design and pre-planning efforts, including the possibility of site acquisition. So to answer your direct question, we are looking at a couple of sites that are state or publicly owned, I should say, including some other sites that are not owned by public entities.
Yeah, and
Representative
Carr. Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. Did you say one of the potential sites was Spring Lake Park?
Mr. Lardy.
Madam Chair, Representative, no. Spring Lake Park is actually the school district that is going to be putting the school on the current site of the velodrome. Our locations are going
They would provide the charter school.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, because if that were to be the site, that's not too different than Blaine, the National Sports Center. I mean, I go up there all the time for hockey and drive by the Spring Lake Park school site, and I've got no problem with Spring Lake Park other than when you reference transportation, it would be the same issue if that's where the facility were located. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Lardy, do you want to care to comment on that?
Yes, thanks. Madam Chair, Representative, so Spring Lake Park is not one of the sites that we're looking at.
Okay. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. Has the Minnesota City High School League taken an interest in making this a sport within the organization?
Mr. Lardy.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we've been having conversations with the leadership of the High School Cycling League about creating a winter season for training and racing at some point down the road for the High School Cycling League kids.
Representative.
Thank you.
Representative Rembeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to ask Mr. Schoquist, is your goal to, well, I guess maybe it is, but I'm noting there's a number of coaches that participated in this event, whatever it was. So there were 753 student athletes and 305 coaches. Just curious about the kind of dollars that our school systems and districts are putting into. Is this a new area they're going to be hiring coaches and trying to fund?
Mr. Schoquist?
Madam Chair, thank you. Actually, the Minnesota State High School Cycling League is completely self-funded, and so schools have no investment, no liability to these teams. Currently, they're operating as club teams, much like a debate club or a chess club for the school. The teams raise their own money to pay modest fees for their coaches. The parents and the kids work to provide the bikes. We have some free bikes that we loan out, too, but we're trying to make this as inexpensive as possible and no cost to the schools.
Representative
Madam Chair, I'm drawing kind of, you know, parallels between the European system of sports being more of a club function, and it seems like that ought to be the direction more so here in our country, because we can't be continuing to expand and put more cost burdens on our schools. So I'm glad to hear what you say. Thank you.
Members, any other questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, Mr. Lardy, you mentioned in your testimony that the current site up in Blaine seems to be rather challenging for some people to get to, and so I'm assuming that the sites that you're referring to are going to be more the direction of going urban. Can you tell us some of the potential sites?
Mr. Lardy?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. We've been evaluating a number of sites. One in particular that we have our eye on is in northeast Minneapolis. It's the Shoreham Yards rail yard location, currently owned by CP Rail. We've also looked at some property in South St. Paul and another facility we're evaluating in St. Paul as well as downtown Minneapolis.
Representative Anderson. Okay. Anyone from the audience that wishes to speak to this bill?
Minneapolis and take home.
Okay, thank you so much. This is really informative. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Members, we're going to go to the technical correction bill that I have, House File 3168. This is just clarifying some language that we needed to cross-reference appropriately and to make sure that our intent is being followed. I don't know if there's anybody here from AMPRS at all that wants to speak to it at all. but I do want to see, do members have any questions? I'm going to move the bill, House File 3168, to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So comments or questions or concerns on this? Anyone from the audience that wishes to speak to this bill? Okay, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 3168 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor, please say aye. Well, I don't have to do that, I guess. Yeah. All right. Now, House File 3129, Representative Kreisha.
Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a process question that, in particular, I'm curious or want to know, and I think I know the answer, whether the committee is actually in possession of this particular
we
House file.
We are not, Representative Johnson, so we're not going to be taking any action on this bill, but we're hearing it for informational purposes, at least. Originally we were going to have a committee meeting on Thursday, but some other requirements came forward, so that's how we had to adjust it. But I at least wanted you to be able to hear this. There are those that, too, have said, you know, we didn't necessarily have to see this bill, but I thought that you would probably appreciate seeing this bill in State Gov. So we have brought it to this committee for informational purposes, and free to ask questions and all that stuff, too. So
thank you, Madam Chair. One of the concerns I had in that respect, I guess, since we don't have a properly engrossed bill, we're unable on this side anyway to move forward with amendments, which we had considered for this particular bill. We can't have anything drafted for it, so that presents a problem process-wise.
Sure.
Given that we're going to be discussing the bill at this time, so that's a concern I have. You know, why not wait till this matter is properly engrossed and then have a thorough discussion?
You will have an opportunity at some point to be able to offer any amendments that you wish to on this bill. So this isn't your only shot, if that's what you're asking.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you suggesting in the omnibus bill, then? Is that what you're...
At some point, maybe later down the road at a different committee hearing, we will give you that opportunity so that if you have amendments you wish to offer, you can do that at that time.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Again, we want to make sure we do respect the process and have the opportunity on this side to provide our input as best we can.
You bet. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Sheldon, for calling out the process as well. I've been through two committees with this, have had only author's amendments at this point, and am more than willing to listen to any and all perspectives on this and would be happy to entertain any amendments that would come up. But this is actually a pretty simple bill, members. What we do is this. In the state of Minnesota for health insurance for school districts, we know a couple of things that are constant. Number one, health insurance is very expensive. When teachers get into looking at their benefit package, they often find that they are difficult to manage. They're expensive for family members, and it can be very difficult for a young family. I've been through that. It can be very expensive. The second thing we know is all the negotiations around these are very contentious because of that. Because a lot of times it's very complicated. There's a lot of information that may be interpreted differently by both sides. And you're into a situation where you have school districts where they're trying for the same goal of educating kids, but when they get into this package, it can become very, very contentious. So all of that in place, we've tried to, through various means, put together packages that reduce the cost, make things fair, and make the process consistent across the state. What we have in statute is the collective bargaining in 471.6161 that says that school districts and the exclusive representatives must come together, and if there's an aggregate value reduction, they must the exclusive representation must agree to that before they go forward. So in other words, both parties need to come together, they need to look at all the bids, and they need to mutually agree on those changes. Now, ultimately, the school district is going to have to enter into a contract because that's what they do, so they have that decision. But before they get there, there has to be the collective bargaining process. That's in statute, okay? And that's fair. I think we would all agree the collective bargaining is there for good reason. I'm not touching that.
The other side of this is we would all agree that competition is good, that lowers costs. We want to look as many bids as we can. And in statute, we say for RFP and for public entities going out for contracts, you must get a minimum of 3 bids. Again, I would think that we would all agree that's great. 3 is great, 7 is wonderful, a billion is probably better. In statute, we say you must get 3. However, in the attempt to try to get to all this, there was a push to put school districts into the public employee insurance program. Which,
and Chairman?
Well, Representative Kahn, he's in the middle of his presentation. Just
I
wait
know,
until after that.
That was a statement that's totally incomprehensible.
You can so. Wait until
I can take that. I mean, I can address that, Madam Chair, if you'd like.
What statement did you not understand?
The thing that a billion would be better. Could you explain how long it would take to examine a billion bids, giving, you know, 1 second
Representative
per bid?
Kahn, I think he was just, you know, giving an example.
Oh, I'm
so,
sorry.
Representative Cresha, please continue.
I will change my number to 7. With that, so when we put this together, there was the idea that PEEP is a viable product and that it should be considered, which I think is absolutely, and you talk to school districts, that's correct. They should be out there, and they should be part of the bidding process, as well as health partners, as well as Medicare, as well as all of them. But what we have done in statute is we've started to carve out exceptions. So remember, our top 3 rules are 3 bids, collective bargaining, except if you're self-insured. So if you're a large school district that's self-insured, these rules don't really apply to you. Or if you are a school district that is in a co-op, you now have another set of rules. Or if you're self-insured with 1,000 employees or more after a certain enactment date. So what we started to do is carve out these rules. Well, what this has done is it's left the larger school districts off by themselves. If you're a larger school district, you can be self-insured on your own. And therefore, because of that, you don't have to go out for bid every 2 years. But all the other school districts do. So, again, we've now gone contrary to the fact that we believe 3 bids is correct. Unless you're a large school district that's self-insured, then guess what? You can just do this on your own. Or guess what? If you're a large school district in PEEP or a school district in PEEP, you can just auto-renew. You don't have to go out for bids. You may, but the other school districts that we've carved down the state must go out for bid every 2 years. And they must seek a PEEP bid. So here's what I submit to you. I'm asking for 3 changes to make this more fair in statute. I'm not pushing an agenda. I'm not trying to go one side or the other. I'm trying to clean up statute. Believe me, I've been square in the middle on this, have listened to both sides. And as I come back to this, what I really realize is our job down here is to be arbiters of good state policy. This state policy has many different exceptions. It has some fundamental flaws in how it carves people out. I'm asking that we just tweak this a bit to go back. So I'm asking for 3 things. Either all schools go to a 2-year bid cycle, or we allow school districts to mutually agree upon that on a 4 or 5 year cycle on their own. So either all schools do it, or we allow it to go to a 4-year cycle, which is what some school districts have, with the caveat that the exclusive representatives in the school districts can decide what they want. If they get together and decide we want to go 2, we want to go 18 months, we want to go 26 months, fine. You do that. You're local control. You have elected school board members. You are governed locally by your people. You should make those decisions. The second thing is, on those 3 bids, we either name all the bids for the school districts or we name none. We shouldn't just name one. Right now what we do is we say school districts in a certain subset have to get 3 bids, one of which has to come from PEEP. But remember, some school districts don't have to get any bids. They can automatically renew. I'm saying you should go get 3 bids, and you should pick those 3 on your own with an exclusive representative and your school administrators coming together. Or we say, here's the 3 that you have to get them from. Right now we're in the middle. The last thing that I'm asking for is there's a section of statute where, remember, collective bargaining is the cornerstone of this. Both sides should come together and decide through this process. However, we've carved out exclusive unilateral decision-making for the teachers' exclusive representation in school districts. Now, I've been a teacher. I know exactly why we're doing it. Teachers are trying to get the best benefit set. However, they are the largest pool in a school district. Let me give you a concrete example. In Little Falls School District, where I reside, the school district considered a PEEP bid that was a little bit higher. They had, I think it was about $150 higher in premiums, and had a subset that was a little bit higher. They had the unilateral decision to go to that subset. They could, as a bargaining unit, say, we want to go to PEEP. They chose not to, and it was just a little bit higher. They did like the bid. They chose not to because when they pull out, they take all of their pool with them, and who's left? Custodians, cafeteria workers, paraprofessionals. Your smaller pools get hurt. They knew, and they looked at the numbers, they said, Ron, if we would have pulled out, we would have driven the premiums up for everybody else in the district. School administrators have the responsibility to put a package together for everybody. So what I'm asking is, let's remove the unilateral decision-making from one organization and go back to the collective bargaining that says the exclusive representation of the largest bargaining union and the school district must agree. That's fair in statute. But what we have now is we have five different cases where we carve out. The last thing that I'll highlight, and I've gotten hundreds of emails, I was told on Monday night that the teachers in my own district had got together and had a dinner, and one of my friends called and said, hey, Ron, by the way, they're saying that you're getting kickbacks. That's why you're doing this bill. That's how some of this information is flowing. But let me give you another highlighted email I got. Today I got an email from a teacher that went through and said, hey, if you take all this away, we're going to lose all of these benefits. These have been great for our school district. The bidding laws are wonderful. Please don't take this away. The teachers from Anoka, they're self-insured. None of this applies to that school district. That's the problem we have. This is very complicated, and we have misinformation. I'm just trying to make this fair across the board because small school districts that I represent, and I have 12 of them, have different sets of rules for all of them. If you are lucky enough to represent one school district, you only have to go by one set of rules. I have to go by five or six. So with that, members, I ask for your consideration on this. I'm more than happy to take any amendments, and I certainly won't use billion in any of my testimony from here on out.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. We have some other testifiers that wish to speak to the bill. We're going to take them at this point. I've got Don Sinner, Marty Fridgen, Joyce Erson, and Mark Schmiesing. If you could please come to the testifier table, all of you, please. Welcome to the committee. Who wishes to speak first?
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Marty Fridgen. I'm a teacher and president of the United Teachers of South Washington County. I appreciate the time given to speak to you today about the benefits of the Health Insurance Transparency Act and how it's affected the lives of our members in District 833. Our district has approximately 2,000 insured employees with about 5,000 insured lives. From 2007 to 2010, our insurance increases were anywhere from 4 to 15%. In 2011, we requested a PEEP bid. Market pressure because of that bid had held our increase in 2011 to 4.7% and a decrease in 2012 of 13%. A 13% decrease for approximately 2,000 employees was significant and allowed for our district to use those savings on other needs. The starting salary for teachers in our district is $35,595. When you have a teacher who's making that salary and pays over $600 a month for insurance, there's not much left on the table after all other necessary deductions are subtracted. Insurance alone will cost that teacher about $7,200 a year. The current Health Insurance Transparency Act not only provides a more transparent process, but enables locals like ours to acquire more uniform and modest increases or decreases in monthly premiums. Based on the information I have shared with you today, I believe the current Health Insurance and Transparency Act should stay in place. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Fridgen. And if you can please state your name for the record.
My name is Don Sinner. I am the president of Education Minnesota Lakeville, not the vice president of Education Minnesota, with all due deference to Paul Mueller.
You've been promoted.
And have been a member of our district insurance committee for the past 15 years. I'd like to apologize first to Joyce Erson of Inver Grove Heights, who is unable to be here today. She had problems securing a sub for this morning. I'm going to speak about the value of the system requirements of HIDA currently in effect and the unintended consequences that this proposed legislation could have. In Lakeville, we are not part of an insurance co-op, but a standalone district for RFPs. We have a pool of 1,200 employees with 3,000 insured lives. because of the competitive bidding process and leverage provided by seeking a peak bid during the RFP process guaranteed by HITA, we have been able to limit premium increases to 4.9% total over the past 5 years. We are able to compare multiple bids from Blue Cross, Health Partners, Medica, and the leverage provided by a peak bid in our district. EML, my unit, works collaboratively with our ESP, our custodial, and our administrative groups in requesting and securing the peak bid. The process has allowed us to retain a sustainable quality, fully insured insurance plan for all district employees, top to bottom. Including a peak bid in our process is actually no extra work for our district, but simply an extra email putting out the bid criteria to another entity. It is actually more work for the members of our committee from the various bargaining units to compare and communicate the bids and the differences in plan designs to our members, seeking their input before decisions are made. This is an invaluable asset in providing a voice and involvement for our members and building a collaborative environment inside our district. It is critical to maintain the right involved in seeking the bids for PEEP for bargaining units, as it helps maintain this collaborative involvement around insurance, which is everyone's issue and everyone's voice is heard. Because of the savings produced by a 7.3 reduction in our premiums over this 2-year contract, we were able to use $750,000 of the $1.5 million in savings to support the implementation and the educator support needed in our local TDE plan. This was a great side benefit of being able to reduce our cost on health insurance because of the HITA requirements. Regarding the ability to seek 4- and 5-year contracts, the ability already exists if agreed upon to the bargaining units. In Lakeville, we have had multiple-year contracts, 3- and 4-year contracts, and 2-year contracts. It has been our experience that remaining with a 2-year cycle has 3 benefits. It aligns the premium rates and insurance with our contract negotiations process, allowing for more predictable insurance and projection of costs in contracts. It forces the providers to bid their premium renewals based on usage patterns, which are factual, rather than projecting based on trends, which at best are a set of smoke and mirrors that lead to higher rates. And third, we are able to set a cap for second-year increases in a 2-year contract. In my experience, going beyond 2 years, you are not going to get a bid with a cap, and that ends up increasing the bids in 3-, 4-, and 5-year contracts. Based on these experiences, I would humbly share my opinion that this bill will not have the positive consequences that many believe it would, and that would be better served to continue using the process placed on us existing through HITA, which I believe is a fair, consistent, balanced, and beneficial for all parties concerned, and it is good policy. Thank you for your attention.
Yes, and Representative Creature, we're just going to go through everybody's testimony, and then we'll go forward. Mr. Schmiesing, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Schmiesing, and I'm with Education Minnesota. One of the major concerns that we continue to hear from our members is the cost of the health care is extremely high. The cost of health insurance is continually rising, with a greater share of paying premium going to the employee. At the same time, plan design is shifting to higher deductibles, copays, and out-of-pocket maximums. This also shifts a greater burden to the employee. We must address these trends so educators have affordable, quality, sustainable health care. The Health Insurance Transparency and Accountability Act provides some guidelines on how school districts can request bids and negotiate over health insurance. One of the major parts of the HITA legislation was to require multiple bids for insurance to increase competition among health care plans. The HITA legislation also required that one of the bids be from an administrator governed by 43A or PEEP, the Public Employees Insurance Group. The requirement to get a PEEP bid places at least one bid in front of districts to provide, if nothing else, a barometer or a comparative tool. This provides the competitive nature of the bidding process and ensures at least one bid the district may or may not have sought on their own. To increase the competitive nature even more, we would propose to increase the number of potential bids by seeking an RFP from all entities that operate within the district. We support the efforts to increase competition. We do not support efforts to reduce competition like this bill does. To comply with the RFP process, a number of districts get a bid from a service provider through a service co-op, and another bid on the same plan from the same service provider without the service call, and count that as two bids. Even though they are essentially the same, the PEEP bid is their third, so really PEEP provides the only real bid from a competitive perspective. The new standards in the HIPAA legislation have only been around for one RFP round, but we have already heard many examples from around the state of how they are helping teachers and their families receive better, less expensive health care. By knowing districts are going to get a PEEP bid, all other providers are aware of the competition and hopefully put their best rates forward. Yesterday, we had testimony in the Educational Finance Committee from teachers in seven rural districts describing how the HIPAA process helped them with their insurance. In fact, of the 78 groups in the public employees insurance pool, school pool, 76 are from rural Minnesota. Two are from the metropolitan area. Also, House File 3129 would extend contracts from 2 to 5 years for groups insurance not provided by co-ops and 4 years for those in co-ops. If a concern is to make the process uniform for all districts, this does not accomplish the goal. We now have a multitude of contract lengths. I also would like to point out, as Mr. Sinner pointed out, that that right exists right now. They simply have to negotiate with the representative of the largest bargaining unit. House File 3129 also eliminates the unilateral right of teachers in a bargaining unit to accept a PEEP bid as outlined in 43A.316 Subdivision 5. This is the only real tool that teachers have if they disagree with the district and the choices the district has made for them. The teachers are the largest consumer of health care in the district. They pay out of pocket for a significant portion of it. They should have an active voice in the selection process. Others argue that a bargaining unit choosing PEEP provides a division between teachers and other employees. It needs to be clearly understood that a PEEP bid is for the entire district. It's not just for the teachers' bargaining unit. It is strongly encouraged that a district move to PEEP if a bargaining unit makes that decision. The PEEP legislation does not prevent other groups in the district from exercising their right to choose the carrier of their choice. I would also add that when a teacher group decides to go to PEEP, it is only after they have carefully examined all other options the district has given them and agree that PEEP is their best option for more affordable health care. Representative Preacher pointed out that that it should be a collaborative process, that not one party should have the right to decide what insurance group is chosen by the district. If the unilateral right to choose PEEP were to go away, the right to choose the insurance carrier falls solely with the district, with the teacher voice only being heard through a collaborative process, but the decision falls solely to the district. In closing, I would like to make clear that this bill does nothing to aid educators in purchasing affordable health care. Education Minnesota strongly opposes the changes offered by House File 3129.
Thank you. Is there anyone else from the audience that wishes to testify to this bill? Representative Crescia.
And thank you, members and Madam Chair. Just a couple of clarifying remarks. Everything they've said here is correct. And we've all agreed upon this. They should get at least three bids. That is in statute. I'm not changing that. You should get three bids. Okay. The second thing is there's this assumption that PEEP has driven costs down. Okay. That may be one corollary way to look at it, but isn't it true that because you have health insurance with health partners or Blue Cross, what's driving costs down is multiple bids, not one carrier? Because remember, these are sealed bids. And the second thing is when I asked here, you're not in PEEP now?
No.
Okay, so everything in here, they could do without my bill. My bill doesn't change any of that. My bill simply says, if we agree that there's a length of contract, and if it's two, then everybody should do it. But read through the legislation. Legislation says 2 years except, and it carves out the larger school districts. To his point, absolutely. And we heard over here that 4 and 5 years is sometimes great. I'm with you on all that, but let's let the local school districts decide that, not statute. Our job is to put together the best policy that we can and be policymakers, not force down statute and laws and mandates for some schools but not others. That's what you have in front of you, is you have a law that forces some school districts into one box, another school into another box, and another one to say, you guys do whatever you want because you're a very large school district.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah. Madam Chair, one of my questions was partially covered by Mr. Sinner and Mr. Schmelzing. I'm a retired teacher, and all the employees in the school district I worked for were under the same health plan. And Mr. Skinner, our Sinner, referenced the fact that you had a committee and that we had a committee in the district I worked for, too, and all the public employees participated in that committee before it went out for bid. Now, that predated the current law, but there was that input in terms of what benefits and so on that they agreed upon among all the various employees that they wanted. So I'm going back, Madam Chair, to the comment about Little Falls. There wasn't anything, in my view, in this current law that would have prevented Little Falls in taking all of their employees into the one health plan that the teachers had worked out. There was no need for people to be so-called left behind. Am I correct on that? For either one of you to comment.
Representative Cresha.
Thank you. Okay, so one way to look at this is you're right. And as I've heard, well, nobody has to be left behind. You can just come along. This is how this works. If I have a nice meat platter at home and my wife is a vegetarian, and I decide that I'm going to have my nice steak, and my wife says, well, I have nothing to eat, I say to her, well, you know, that's not true. You can eat my stuff. That's what we're doing to these providers. We're saying, no, you don't have to be left behind. You can come with us. We've decided to go this route. Instead of saying, how are we all in this together? So instead of me going and buying broccoli for my wife and me to both eat together, one side is unilaterally pulling out and having a steak dinner and leaving the other ones to fend for themselves.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, on that question, I would like to also, if I may, hear from either of the two or both that testified. And maybe Mr. Sinner could talk a little bit more about the committee that you referenced in your school district and how that functioned before, I assume, before you went out for bid.
Mr. Sinner.
Madam Chair, Representative, in our district we have every single bargaining unit that sit in an ongoing insurance committee. And we do vote by proxy, and I have the ability as the largest bargaining unit to go unilaterally, but we do not do that. We build a collaborative environment through that committee because health insurance is an issue for every single one of our employees, from our superintendent down to our part-time tutors that work for us and work for students. We're all there to work for students, but our collaborative environment through our insurance committee gets us where everybody goes the same way to seek the bids and then to decide which bids work together. In fact, when we had the PEEP bid and we were considering fully insured, self-insured, and a PEEP possibility before the last contract, I actually took it on and went to every single site in my district. That's 17 separate school sites, and I led the meetings, including the administrators, including every bargaining group at that site, and we explained all the possibilities, all the plan designs and everything, and we communicated and took the voice of everybody. So it is a collaborative process when the committee works together. We're not unilateral in any way.
Yeah, and Madam Chair,
Representative Carlson.
That's why I referenced the experience I had as a classroom teacher, that all employees were involved in the process. And I would think it would be in everybody's interest, again, pointing to Little Falls being that they were referenced, that the pool be as large as possible. And that would be probably what would bring people together as well. With my limited knowledge of insurance, I would just point out that when you do have that opportunity for a larger pool, it's sometimes surprising what the bids will come in at. Now, it's unrelated to this, but it's a good example. I participated for many years with the Midwest Higher Education Compact, 12 states, and they've negotiated, if you will, opportunities for bids with something like 900 colleges and universities across the Midwest. And I had conversations with the U of M, and they said, well, we're big. We get the best bids possible. And I said, well, you ought to check into it. They came back on their own and said, you know, we checked into it, and by golly, we got a much better bid because of the larger pool. When you bring that down to a Little Falls school district, and I assume by bringing all the employees into that process, it's going to be better for everyone, and that would be the motivation to be inclusive, I would assume, and it sounds like you are inclusive. So, Madam Chair, I'll stop there, and thank you.
Representative Lennon.
Madam Chair, one quick comment, if I could.
Yes, Representative Crescia.
What you've heard today with Little Falls and with what you did, that should absolutely be written in a statute. And when people are given the chance to do it right, they do it right. But that's not what statute does. Statute gives exclusive unilateral decision to some groups, but what he did is absolutely right. I would take his words and put that in statute if I could, because when given the chance, people make the right decision.
Representative Lumen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is someone from PEEP here today?
Welcome to the committee. Representative Lunan, your question.
When PEEP proposes bids, what percentage of the bids that you give end up resulting in a sale?
And if you could please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and Representative Lunan, my name is Julie Sonier. I'm Director of the Employee Insurance Division at Minnesota Management and Budget, and in that role I oversee PEEP as well as CGIP. I can tell you that in the most recent, year and a half period, PEEP has given, specifically for school districts, 316 quotes, of which 21 of those groups joined PEEP.
Representative Lunan.
Okay, that makes, contends a point that was made earlier that PEEP gives a competitive bid, and I'm not, I was on the school board for years. I was on the personnel committee every one of those years, and a 33-year insurance agent. And some of the points the testifiers contend are wrong. First of all, and Representative Carlson made a good point, the larger the pool, the smaller the margin of error for the risk analysis for the insurance carrier. Therefore, you get a more effective bid. That's just the economy of scale. There was a point made by one of the testifiers that a two-year bid allows for more stability than a four-year bid. That too is wrong, in that just like when you go to a bank, if you put money in a certificate of deposit, you get a more favorable contract the longer that money's in there, because the bank can predict risk down the road further. Now, PEEP is critical because PEEP is a last-stop shop. If a district has an adverse group, it's critical that PEEP's around. It is the safety net. But as far as a competitive tool, any bid you get from another carrier is going to give you that. When we talk about the splitting out the different groups, the school board is vested with the responsibility of taking care of all of the members. The teachers union, rightfully so, is responsible for the betterment of the best situation for the teachers. And I think we as legislators need to believe and trust our school board members to make these decisions and do the things like they've done in Lakeville collaboratively, but to give them that option. The more options we give our local school district, the better the decision is going to be made. The closer the decision is made to the situation, the more accurate the decision is going to be. When we take a look at the closing ratio on that, I have one other question for PEEP is, does everyone who requests a bid from PEEP receive one?
Ms. Sonia?
Madam Chair and Representative Lunan, yes, that's the case. I think you may be referring to a situation that occurred prior to my tenure at PEEP, where I think at one point there was a misunderstanding from a self-insured school district that requested a bid. Other than that one situation, yes, everyone who requests a bid from PEEP receives one.
Okay, and then the
Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The reason that should be in there is because, again, you have a small outstate district, and you have a couple of health issues. That's profound in that group, and what happens is the risk of one is spread across the many, and that's the role that PEEP plays. It's not the low ball bidder, and it would be unfair to contend that that's what it is, because its role is much more important than that as a safety net for some of these small districts. The provisions in this bill allow a school district a functional savings in that they don't have to go through the administrative cost of an RFP if they've already got several competitive bids. It keeps the competitive process in there, requiring three of them.
Very good. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll make this fairly brief. There's been a lot of discussions and implications around here, and it seems like we revolve around the issue of PEEP, in which I really don't think this bill is specifically targeting PEEP of any sort, but the implication is that PEEP is the critical factor in keeping bids low, and so therefore you always had to have a bid from PEEP. And so my question for PEEP representative, are you aware of anywhere in this legislation and this bill that excludes school boards from getting PEEP bids?
Ms. Swiner?
Madam Chair and Representative, no, it does not.
Representative Petersburg. Thank you, Madam Chair. And so that kind of begs the question. So are we just concerned that we're not giving exclusive rights to PEEP? Is that the biggest issue? And if it is, then I think we that's another issue to deal with at another time. But it does seem like an opportunity for us to put everybody kind of in the same playing field is certainly beneficial, and it's just my opinion. Thank you.
Members seeing no other questions. Representative Grisha, last word.
And thank you. And thank you to all the testifiers and your questions. The only thing I would add, and Representative Petersburg, you said it very eloquently, if the exclusive right was health partners, I'd be doing this exact same thing here, attacking the process of picking one vendor over others. If it was Blue Cross, I'd be doing, this is not an anti-PEEP bid. This is a clean up the statute and make it fair for school districts the best we can. All I'm asking is some concessions and some fairness for our little schools that are sitting out in rural Minnesota.
Great. Thank you, Representative Cresha. And Representative Johnson, I encourage you to work with Representative Cresha on the changes or suggestions that you have. So,
thank you.
Members, with that.
Madam Chair, just one brief question, if I may.
Yep.
Since we're not meeting tomorrow, I couldn't help but wonder if maybe targets are forthcoming, and if you can give us any update on when you expect that and when we can have some information in that regard.
You know what? Maybe Representative Carlson has a better idea. He's the lead on the Ways and Means Committee. That would be done through there. So I don't know if Representative Carlson, you have anything to add on that at all.
Well, Madam Chair, I would only say this, that the rumors are rampant that some chairs have gotten targets or have a pretty good idea of what their targets are. We meet, Madam Chair, tomorrow night, and I'm assuming the budget resolution would come up, but I guess maybe the question is, have some committee chairs or have you received a target, or do you expect a target prior to tomorrow night?
You know, if I get a target, you know, we'll have lengthy conversations here in committee about it, and have to go through that whole process too. So it'll be no different than it was last year. So
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson's our lead, so I don't want to jump ahead of him on these questions, but if you do get your target prior to tomorrow night, would you be able to share that with the minority?
You know, when I get the target and we see it in Ways and Means, everybody will be able to have a chance to provide feedback on it at that point. So I'd encourage members to watch the Ways and Means agenda, I guess, because that's where it kind of all starts and has to happen. So
Madam Chair, I think from what you're saying,
you have suggestions. Let me ask you that.
You don't have a target yet, is what I think you're saying, or...
Right. All I've got so far, basically, is the governor's budget. I don't know if this is, if the governor's budget is the route that you guys are interested in taking. I haven't gotten feedback from Representative Johnson on that, so I don't know if you're endorsing the governor's proposal wholeheartedly or kind of where you're at on that process. So if you've got feedback on that, too, I think that that would be helpful, or just the budget overall, too. So.
Well, Madam Chair, we all know how Ways and Means operates, and whether or not we are supportive of a given budget initiative committee, it's always generally predetermined. So the ability to, if we did want to go along with a particular budget initiative, whether it's the governor's or our own, as you well know, it's very difficult to change the resolution once it comes forward. That's one of the reasons I think we were kind of interested if whether these rumors are accurate or not. There was some discussion on the House floor, if you recall, on that question the other day when the minority leader asked if targets had been released, and Representative Knobloch responded that they had not been, but then almost a week has since passed, and tomorrow night is when the targets will be publicly released. But that's a slightly different question, I think, than what I was asking, is in terms of public release, or if the chairs or yourself have received any information prior to that. I would assume you've had some input into what your target may be. When I chaired Ways and Means, I always met with the committee chairs to mm-hmm. get input from all of them in terms of what their needs were, whether that was different than a given governor or not. But we would meet and have that discussion so we could respond to the various committees as we could. So that's what I think we're asking, but you haven't had any number that has come forward, I think, is what you're saying.
No, you know, I think if we've seen what the governor has come out with, I'm sure Chair Knobloch's probably looking at those figures and a whole host of things. But I would encourage you, if you do have budget items, by all means, please share them. Representative Johnson mentioned that he had some amendments for the last bill that we heard. Love to see what those are and take a look at those too. And any other suggestions that you have, I'd love to hear kind of what your feedback is on the, if you think that we need to have a supplemental budget or not. If you do, where would you, what would you do with that and so forth. So we're all part of this process, so any suggestions you have, I'd like to hear. So,
well, maybe just one final question, Madam Chair. Have you had an opportunity to meet with Representative Knobloch to make requests on behalf of the committee?
You know, I always talk to Representative Knobloch about different issues that we see coming through this committee. Obviously, he knows all the bills that are referred to our committee. I will tell you that much of the focus has been that this is a bond year and not a budget year. And so that's why we've been hearing so many of the bonding bills. Not to act on them, but I think it is helpful for us to get a chance to hear those bills in this committee, because at some point we may be seeing them down the road if they're included as part of the bonding bill. So that's where my focus has been, is on the bonding year that we have and the bond bills that are part of this committee. So with that, members, we are adjourned.